Israeli forces killed two Palestinians and injured nearly a dozen more during the military operation in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Russia says that the Odessa missile attack hit the Ukrainian military infrastructure, that after Kyiv accused Moscow of failing to keep its promises. Also in the headlines, a heavy wildfire prompting a state of emergency and massive evacuations in parts of the U.S. state of California. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Another deadly Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. At least a couple of Palestinians have been killed in clashes in the northern city of Nablus. The two men were aged 29 and 22. The Palestinian Red Crescent has also reported 19 injuries, including 10 people hit by live fire. Palestinian reporters have described the raid as a full-blown military invasion. Israeli forces also stormed the flashpoint city of Jenin. Hamas says that the ongoing confrontations in the occupied West Bank prove that the Palestinian uprising will not stop until the end of the Israeli occupation. According to the movement, resistance across West Bank cities will not be broken. Israeli forces have killed at least 50 Palestinians in the occupied territories since late March. The journalists, writers, politicians, and activists have gathered in the Lebanese town of Nagura, where they voiced support for the Lebanese negotiating team in the maritime dispute with the Tel Aviv regime. Mariam Saleh has the details.
A gathering of Lebanese journalists and activists was held in the South Lebanon town of Naqoura to protest against Israel's extraction activities in the disputed waters.
We are so powerful, we can fight, we can go to war in case the enemy wants a war, unless we get our rights and our wealth in the sea and on the land.
Former head of the Lebanese negotiating team believed any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the other party.
One of the strongest point is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation of for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form of diplomatic or political or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker Minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July.
We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed. Behind me are blocks 10 and 9, both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The Turkish military has conducted heavy shelling on two areas in northern and western Syria, causing casualties and material damage. According to reports, the mortar and artillery fire in Zargan district have left one civilian dead and four others injured. Other attacks hit sites in Tal Tamer and the western province of Hasaka, including a Russian base. Military sources saying that there have been 80 Turkish attacks in less than an hour. On Thursday, Turkish President Erdogan renewed his threat to launch a military operation in Syria, allegedly to stem anti-Ankara terrorists. Damascus views Turkey's operations as a violation of its sovereignty. The Russian Foreign Ministry says that the Saturday attack on the southern Ukrainian port city of Odessa hit a military infrastructure. According to spokeswoman Maria Zakharova, a naval boat was among the targets hit in what she described as a high-precision strike. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russia of breaking its promise to implement a grain deal with the attack on the port. Odessa is a key Black Sea terminal for the export of Ukrainian grain. The attack came less than 24 hours after Russia and Ukraine agreed with the UN and Turkey on the reopening of the Black Sea ports for grain exports. Hungary is urging the EU to change its strategies on Ukraine, saying that Western sanctions on Moscow have failed.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
The Hungarian Prime Minister says that the sanctions were aimed at destabilizing Russian leadership in the war, but Ukraine will never win the war that way, as the Russian army has asymmetrical dominance. Viktor Orban also said that the war can come to an end only through peace talks between Russia and the U.S. He has stressed that Hungary is unwilling to support the EU's limitations on Russian gas imports. Orban warned that this would undermine European economy. The bloc has imposed a wave of sanctions on Russia, targeting key sectors. Record high temperatures are causing France to take increasingly drastic measures amid the West sanctions campaign against Russia. Citizens are being asked to conserve power, with energy cuts this winter already being called a certainty. Rami Mazahar reports from Paris.
Due to their decision to sanction Russia over the unrest in Ukraine, France and the European Union are desperately trying to build energy stocks ahead of this winter. However, a record heat wave has created a surge in energy consumption, and that's prompted the government to informally call for the rationing of electricity. Citizens have been pushed to make an effort by cutting off Wi-Fi, unplugging appliances, and going without air conditioning. Many in poor neighborhoods say they expect their streets to go dark earlier and for their social services to be affected first. The West's sanctions campaign against Russia continues to force the average household into paying a steep price.
It's very difficult to see this crisis getting better by 2023. Finding alternative sources for gas and petrol will cause higher prices. Renewable energy will be more expensive. France isn't a big coal producer. France is already depleting its petrol and gas stocks. So every choice away from Russian energy is going to increase energy prices.
In order to have more control over the national energy grid, this week the government announced that they will totally renationalize the company Electricity of France. The energy giant runs all of the nation's nuclear power plants. Nuclear power provides nearly 70% of France's energy, the most of any country in the world. But a recent series of outages have caused nuclear power output to drop to its lowest level in nearly 30 years. Leaders of French energy corporations recently said that energy cuts are certain for this winter and that prolonged cold spells may threaten social and political cohesion.
The best solution is to negotiate with Russia to end the war in Ukraine. But we also need the leaders of the European Union to stop living in an isolated fishbowl, where pushing for more war is a good idea. This energy and economic crisis is affecting all citizens.
A proposal to give the European Union the right to impose mandatory gas rationing across the bloc's 27 member countries was immediately shot down by the nations of Southern Europe this week. They called it the farthest-reaching power grab by Brussels this year. And it was especially controversial because individual national vetoes were not allowed under an emergency procedure employed by the leaders of the European Union. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
More than 500 U.S. firefighters working to extinguish a wildfire that has ripped through thousands of acres in California. Over a dozen properties have already been destroyed or badly damaged. Emergency personnel are trying to evacuate residents and protect structures. Some 6,000 people were evacuated as the fire remained 0% contained as of Saturday evening, local time. The blazes left behind ashes, gutted vehicles, and twisted remains of property in its wake. It broke out after a heat wave swept across multiple regions, pushing up temperatures. Officials saying that the fire could take a week to contain. Over to The Hague now, where the International Court of Justice is set to proceed with a case concerning allegations of genocide against minority Rohingya Muslims. The UN's highest court has thrown out all of the objections by Myanmar military to a case filed by the Gambia. The junta said the court has no jurisdiction to matter. Rights groups have hailed the ICJ's decision as a great moment for justice for Rohingya. They say there is now a possibility to challenge the military's impunity. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya fled majority Buddhist Myanmar in 2017 amid harrowing reports of murder, rape, and arson. In a provisional decision 2 years ago, the court ordered Myanmar to protect the Rohingya from genocide. South Korean activists and their supporters have gathered for a peace festival near the demilitarized zone. They want an end to the Korean War, and they want to replace the armistice with a peace treaty. The festival comes as the new South Korean president is boosting his country's alliance with the U.S. and planning joint military drills for next month. Frank Smith has more.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together, 80 million people for peace. Let's get together, people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because everyone wants to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world, so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. Frank Smith, Imjingak, South Korea.
Britain's ruling Conservative Party has become embroiled in a new Islamophobia scandal, and that after a right-wing tabloid revealed Number 10 placing a boycott on a senior mainstream Muslim organization. The ban was originally resolved in 2010. Still, it remained an ongoing obstacle for Muslim representation in British political circles. Robert Carter explains.
Anger has been caused amongst British Muslims after a right-wing newspaper attacked Conservative leadership contender Penny Mordaunt for flouting a so-called government boycott of Britain's largest Muslim group. Following the article's release earlier this week, Muslim activists and even a Muslim Labour MP condemned the government over their admission of the ban.
This long-held secret boycott of a mainstream Muslim group by Number 10 was finally admitted on the front page of a tabloid press. The record of this government is that the Prime Minister's comments led to 375% increase in attacks on Muslim women.
The boycott centres on the Muslim Council of Britain, which claims to be the UK's biggest umbrella organisation of Muslim groups. In 2009, the then Labour government indeed cut ties with the group, over a row regarding comments criticising Israeli aggression on Palestine. Although the ban was reversed a year later, successive Tory governments have continued to enforce it without much explanation. Onlookers believe the so-called policy is less about combating extremism and more about gagging legitimate Muslim voices.
Here we have an institution that represents very well and not extreme and, you know, having a variety of individuals, educated and professional, and coming across to give their views for, you know, the Muslims that do live in the United Kingdom. And here we have even that to be stopped. So it's really sad. It's quite disappointing. And I also would like to understand why that is actually happening. And once again, it's a target for Muslims. Yet they are showing, not just by their voice, but now in action, that they're actually doing worse and calling out others for being in that way when they are doing it themselves.
In comments that were released earlier in the week, the council did admit that since 2009's ban by the then Labour government, the council and its representatives have met up with some elected members of different parties, including the Conservatives. So questions still surround why this boycott is still being enforced by the current government. Those questions may take some time to answer. Robert Carter, London.
Well, that's all for this news broadcast from Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. The law of gravity is a law that is in front of our eyes, and everyone understands it. But there are also laws that not everyone can understand. The whole Qur'an is truly filled with verses about these laws. For example, it says, Allah is with those who guard against evil. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 2, verse 194. And whoever strives hard, he strives only for his own soul. The Holy Qur'an, Surah 29, verse 6. And there are other such verses, which I will now discuss, that are laws too. And who is truer of word than Allah? The Holy Quran, Surah 4, verse 122.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
God says that this is a law. One of these laws is Allah will help him who helps his cause. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 40. Allah will help him has been emphasized in this verse. Or there is the verse, if you help the cause of Allah, he will help you. The Holy Quran, Surah 47, verse 7. This is one of the divine traditions. If the path you are traveling, the work that you are doing, your direction is helping God. Helping God here means helping God's religion and the divine values. If you move in this direction, you will be victorious and God will help you. Of course, the condition is that you must move and take action yourself too. Don't just say something. You must take action. This is a divine tradition. If you are grateful, I will certainly give you more. The Holy Quran, Surah 14, verse 7. If you use a divine blessing in the right place, God will increase that blessing for you. This is a divine tradition. As for those who strive hard for us, we will most certainly guide them in our ways, and Allah is most surely with the doers of good. The Holy Quran, Surah 29, verse 69. All of these are divine traditions.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the crisis in Ukraine lingers on, the United States and its allies appear to run out of measures to halt Russia. They have imposed various sanctions on Moscow. Russia's energy, banking, and financial sectors have been targeted by the West. But the punitive measures do not appear to have the intended results. Now, the United States is proposing the idea of putting a price cap on Russia's oil.
This is more suicidal stuff from the West. I mean, one thing which this Western-centric, this US-centric, European-centric view of themselves as being indispensable parts of the world, I think is the main problem here, because they view themselves as the center of the universe, so to speak, in everything, in politics, economics, etc. However, they fail to understand that the world is rapidly changing.
The West is trying to limit the price of Russia's oil in order to deprive the country from the money it needs to run the war. The goal is said to be to set the price at a level that covers the marginal cost of production so that Russia would be encouraged to keep producing oil. The idea, which was first proposed by Washington, was agreed upon at the G7 summit back in June. Western countries plan to allow only those raw material and oil products whose value does not exceed the price cap. In reaction to the proposed idea, Russia has threatened that it would not export oil to the world market if a price cap is imposed. If these prices, which they are talking about, are lower than the costs for oil production, naturally, Russia will not ensure the supply of this oil to the world market, which means that we simply will not work at a negative profit. It's not yet clear whether Western nations have the capability to implement such a plan, but there are already warnings that this scheme may actually backfire. Russia's president says the price cap would further propel global oil prices, and Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev has warned that oil would be traded between $300 to $400 per barrel if the West goes through with the plan.
The European markets and the US markets are not the prime markets for Russian energy supplies. The prime markets are now Asia, and so they're out of step with what is happening in the world. And what this will do will exacerbate, as you noted, an already rather tenuous energy crisis, which is caused by, on the one hand, shortages of energy supplies, and on the other hand, costs of energy supplies. Because to cap it, who's going to sell it to the West under the production cost? No one, especially when the West treats them the way that they are treating them. So, I mean, it's going to be another shot in the foot for the US and its vassal and client states.
Some analysts are predicting that the scenario would be catastrophic for the US and the other group of seven countries. Market watchers have predicted that China and India, two key players in the Asia region, may not cooperate with the price cap. Western sanctions on Russia have already failed to deprive the country from its revenues. They have actually increased the money Moscow makes from its energy exports. Oil prices climbed to 14-year highs shortly after the war began on February 24. They remain above $100 per barrel. According to other analysts, history shows that such attempts end in failure. The US tried to fix prices for oil in the 1970s, and the UK tried to set the forex prices in the 80s. All those attempts failed, and the prices boomed after those debacles.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has advised the visiting Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, against any aggression in northern Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei told Erdogan that any military action in northern Syria will definitely harm Turkey, Syria and the entire region and will instead benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei described as very important the issue of Syria's territorial integrity and said a military incursion of Syria will only benefit terrorists. Ayatollah Khamenei further added that Iran considers security in Turkey and its border areas as its own. He called on Turkey to pursue a similar approach vis-a-vis its neighbor, Syria. For his part, President Erdogan accused the United States of feeding terrorist organizations in Syria. He further said Russia and Iran should support Turkish operations in Syria. Erdogan said Ankara believes Tehran and Moscow have the same opinion on Kurdish YPG militants operating in northern Syria.
Strategically, both Iran and Russia have taken the correct approach. They are focusing on the removal of the US threat first, and I think they believe they can deal with Mr. Erdogan after that, because after all, his key pretext for intervening in Syria and trying to annex part of Syria is the threat from Kurdish separatists who are facing his troops south of the border there. At the moment, there's a collaboration with the Syrian army and the Kurdish separatists in some areas of the north of Syria.
In recent months, Turkey has been mauling a military operation in northern Syria against Kurdish militants that Ankara considers as terrorists. The militants are located in the cities of Tal Rifat and Manbij.
Effectively, there is some common ground there between Iran and Turkey in relation to the Kurdish proxies, which are being trained by Israel and by the US in the north of Iraq now. So the situation is complicated, but I think that, as I said, the priority of getting rid of the US occupation has to be recognized there, even though there are many people who are very concerned about the role Mr. Erdogan's been playing for many years now.
The meeting was followed by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad's visit to Tehran. Miqdad said Damascus will not tolerate the violation of its territorial integrity. Iran, Russia and Turkey have held a trilateral summit on the Syrian peace process. The summit was the seventh meeting of the Astana process. It was held on Tuesday in Tehran and attended by Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Принятым совместным заявлением подтверждена приверженность укреплению трехстороннего.
We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism, and there is the need to do so, and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region.
Raisi further slammed the U.S.'s unilateral sanctions on Syria. The sanctions have put additional pressure on the Syrian people and deprived them of the possibility of a normal life.
The primary focus, the priority has to be to get the U.S. out of Syria and Iraq, by the way, because, of course, the use of terrorist groups is something that the U.S. is the mastermind of, basically, and it's been behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda, all of those associated groups using the Saudis and so on.
And the biggest problem today, it was mentioned, the common will to fight international terrorism there, and also the foreign forces, meaning here the American forces and the others, that they should leave the Syrian territory.
The U.S. invaded Syria in 2014 after supporting terrorists in the country. Washington began stealing and smuggling the Syrian crude from the oil-rich eastern province of Deir al-Zor and elsewhere under former American President Donald Trump.
As the underpinnings of many Western countries are being called into question, China is holding out both its political and economic model as a thriving alternative. Over the past four decades, Beijing has increasingly asserted its power on the global stage and is now on course to become the world's biggest economy even sooner than predicted pre-pandemic. But now, as the world undergoes changes unseen in decades, China alongside Russia seem to be embroiled in a battle with the West both in terms of economies and military might, a battle which the West seems to be on the losing side. Amid simmering tensions between the two sides, the former British Prime Minister says the Ukraine war is an indication of the West's diminishing dominance. Tony Blair stated that the West's dominance is coming to an end as China rises to superpower status in partnership with Russia at one of the most significant inflection points in centuries.
The collective West needs to take into account now is that they are not alone. They need to stop their imperialist way of approaching how they see the world. They tend to say, well, the global worlds, but when they say the global world, they only mean maybe 15% of the population. But the problem now is that they don't have the weight they used to have, and they need to take into account that you have an emerging world, and we are living the last days of the imperialistic West.
From trade wars against China to sanctions on many countries including Russia, Iran and Venezuela, the West has in the past decade went on a rampage against any nation not willing to play by its rules. But now the West's risky games have backfired, and signs of distress are multiplying with falling currency valuation, social crisis, inflation, poverty and much more. Those coercive measures also, however, push targeted nations closer to each other, setting the foundations of a multilateral world. In the 1960s, while the US was putting a man on the moon, China was struggling to feed its 1 billion people during the decade-long Cultural Revolution. The US was enjoying a favorable economic environment, and China, on the other hand, was faced with a completely stagnant and ruined economy coupled with widespread famine. But nearly two decades later, in light of vast economic reforms, China opened up to private businesses and foreign investment. dominant state-owned bank turned savings into financing tools for roads, rail links, and ports, all this while foreign firms were forced to set up alongside a local partner, encouraging the transfer of technology. As a result, the economy grew 90-fold over the next four decades. But history clearly shows that plagues and wars are things that either cause the downfalls of particular order or cause a rethink. So when these disasters arise, a void is created waiting to be filled by a superior nation or nations.
I think it's not about, you know, either one pole or the other. You know, we might enter into a bipolar world or ideally a multipolar world. It doesn't mean that it's going to be a complete downfall. You know, the world needs the West. It's not about either or, it is about how we can live together. But if the West keeps on going into this direction, it might be a downfall, especially when you look at the economy. How are they going to manage when the dollar is not going to be the global currency? Now the dollar being a global currency makes the US, gives the US this power to print endless paper, which is backed by nothing. So that, if we talk about downfall, well, we might have an economic downfall, because the day that the dollar is no more the global currency, hegemonic currency, then you will experience hyperinflation, and it could be extremely dramatic.
In the past couple of years, not only China, but several sovereign nations, including Russia and Iran, demonstrated the power which can be gained through sovereignty. And countries relying on the West, on the other hand, presented an example of the problems that could arise upon relying on others. From the formation of new allegiances such as the BRICS or the G20, to a shift away from a unipolar world and dependency on the US, all signs indicate a shift in global order towards a multilateral world. Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians in the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
The European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Dear sisters and brothers, welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Q&A on Islamic belief, where we shed light on your main questions. I am Asma, your host for today's episode, and here with us We have Brother Nur Muhammad, the scholar of religious studies. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to your home and thank you for coming.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me and I'm happy to be here.
It's actually a pleasure to be with you. So the first question is like this. Was Muawiyah the writer of holy text, I mean the scripture, or has he ever done any sacred writings? This is the first part of the question. And then you answer this and we go to the other part of the question.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that actually the answer to this question is negative. If you go to the, you know, the books of Ahlul Sunnah, you can find a lot of points and, the, you know, actually the basis of this point is one single narration in Sahih Muslim. In the Sahih Muslim, actually, we have one narration talking about the three requests of Abu Sufyan from Noble Prophet Muhammad, one of which was to assign his son Muawiyah to be a writer and a scriber of revelation of Noble Quran. And actually, Noble Prophet Muhammad accepted, according to this false narration, Noble Prophet Muhammad accepted his request and assigned Muawiyah to be a, you know, writer and a scriber of revelation of Noble Quran. But if you go to the interpreter of the Sahih Muslim, you can find many of them, and actually all of them rejected this narration. And they said that this narration actually is false. For example, we have the Nawawi in his commentary. He said that, you know, it is not accepted narration. Al-Qadi, Ibn Hazm, and many other, you know, Sunni scholars that rejected the authenticity of this narration. And even Shamsuddin Dhahabi, one of the most famous Sunni scholar with regard to the narration, and traditionalist, he say that this narration is not accepted. Let me quote the exact, you know, statement of Dhahabi. وَفِي صَحِيحِ مُسْلِمْ قَدْ سَاقَ لَهُ أَصْلًا مُنْكَرًا أَنْ إِبْنَ أَبَّاسِ. He said that in Sahih Muslim about this particular narration, he said that there is a unacceptable narration which has been quoted and ascribed to Ibn Abbas. So you find that actually we can say most of the Sunni respected scholars with regards to the narration and tradition, they rejected the authenticity of this narration. So we can say that this narration is baseless. And for example, some of them, they said that هَذَا الْحَدِيثِ وَحْمٌ مِنْ بَعْضِ الرُّبَاطِ. They said that this particular narration is very weak. I think it has been, you know, been very clear that the narration which talking about the, and the hadith which talking about the, whether Muawiyah was writer and a scriber of the revelation of Noble Quran, yes, mm-hmm. is false.
So the first question is negative. The answer to it is negative, and we understood that he has never had any hand in writing those holy or sacred texts.
Let me add that, of course, about the writing of the revelation of Noble Quran, actually he has no role to play over there. But about the ordinary letters of the Noble Prophet, actually, Muawiyah, maybe he has done some work over there. For example, according to some of the scholars, they say that معاوية وكان معاوية يكتب للنبي فيما بينه وبين العرب. I'm quoting this statement from Al-Madani.
So it was not a sacred text.
Yes, exactly. He said that كان زيد بن ثابت يكتب الوحي. For example, زيد بن ثابت and some other companion of noble prophet, peace and blessing be upon him and his pure progeny, they were writing the revelation. But Muawiyah was writing some of the ordinary letters of the noble prophet mm-hmm. with, for example, some other people.
Yes, thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So we go to the other part of the question, that is like this. Is being the writer of holy texts a proof to claim the immunity of the writer from all the sins or any other evil deeds?
Again, the answer is negative, because if you write the revelation of Noble Quran, it doesn't mean that you are sinless, infallible individual.
Mm-hmm.
You see that talking about the Noble Quran itself, Noble Quran is pure from any, and actually it is immune from any distortion, omission, and addition, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, of course, we have many evidences about that, many verses of Noble Quran and many rational proof and argument for the immunity of Noble Quran to be away from any distortion. But that individual is writing and, you know, have some kind of writing about the revelation. This individual, it does not mean that that particular individual is sinless and infallible.
Mm.
And the reason of that, you see that some of the writers of the revelation, for example, like Abdullah ibn Abi Sarh, he was a writer of revelation, but he apostatized. And, you know, very clearly, and many scholars, they have been quoted this historical fact that this individual and companion of Noble Prophet Muhammad, he was writing the revelation of Noble Quran, but he apostatized. So there is no reason that that individual is writing the revelation is immune from any other error and sin.
And also we have it in the Holy Book of Quran. I don't remember exactly the verse, but there is the concept that says there are those who write the book, but they do not believe in it.
Maybe we have in some verse of Noble Quran, but, you know, rationally speaking, the person is writing a revelation. It does not mean that that individual is immune from any
or
other
infallible,
sin.
Yes.
Or infallible. You know, infallibility is God-given privilege that
yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has gave it to the infallible Ahlul Bayt. You know, 14 infallible Ahlul Bayt, and of course for some other messengers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with different, you know, stages and levels on infallibility.
Mm-hmm.
But talking about other people, nobody claimed that those companions, they were pure from any, you know, error and sins. And, you know, the mere writing of the revelation does not mean that those individuals and people, they were, you know, infallible people.
Yeah.
So I want to say that, you know, rationally speaking, it is not mere writing of revelation. It does not mean that individual is immune from any kind of error and mistake. You see that, for example, about the, some people, they claim that the, for example, the companions of Noble Prophet Muhammad, they were all of them, they are just, they did not commit any mistake. But of course, we have some differences in, you know, let's say in other school. Yes, we have some differences in other schools of thought. Mm-hmm. Some of the people, they believe that they, all of them, they were just. Some of them, they believe that, you know, other ideas about this issue. But after all, we have some other evidences supporting the, you know, this idea that mere writing the revelation does not mean that
the person is infallible.
This infallible. I think it is, rationally speaking, it is very clear for those people to who reflect about this issue. But after all, we prove this idea and we explain that the Muawiyah was not writer of revelation of Noble Quran at all.
So thank you for nice information. Dear listeners, you are listening to IRB English Radio. I hope today's episode was up to your expectation and helped you figure out your questions. For furthermore of diverse information, you can visit parstoday.com. Until next session and a new episode of Q&A, may Allah shower you with His blessings. Thank you for being with us.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
The beginning of the end. Part 2.
When Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities were targeted in drone attacks, Riyadh could hardly imagine that the consequences of the face-off with Yemen would be so harsh. Saudi Arabia is Yemen's largest neighbor and the largest country in the Arabian Peninsula. Most of the country is comprised of vast deserts, Saudi Arabia owes its significance among Arab and Islamic countries to two holy and religious cities of Mecca and Medina. Islam is the birthplace of Saudi Arabia and was exported to other countries.
after the discovery of oil, Saudi Arabia gradually became one of the, or I better say, the biggest oil exporter in the world. Saudi Arabia's significance today is a combination of the historical significance